Namaste. I would like to begin with two questions that were received. Both are very relevant to the teaching in daily living. Rameshji, in his talks, says that the human being suffers if their will does not correspond with God's will. So my confusion is not the non-correspondence of my will with God's will also God's will? To be more precise, is anything and everything God's will, or are only major circumstances in our life God's will? This is a good question, which says, as he quotes Rameshji, that human beings suffer if their will does not correspond with God's will. And so the confusion is not the non-correspondence of my will with God's will also God's will? You see, there is nothing apart from God. God is the totality. God is what is. God is consciousness. There is nothing that is not God. There is nothing that is not the source. There is nothing that is not consciousness. And as we have been going through the concepts of this teaching, even my individual will is not really shaped by me, but rather my genetics and my conditioning, which make up my nature. And on the basis of that nature, I think and act. So that too is God's will. Now the point is, the sentence, human beings suffer when their will does not correspond with God's will. You see, this suffering is brought about by consciousness. And it is the suffering and the loss that make an individual start questioning, what is life about? That is God's will. When we accept that nothing is out of the purview of God's will, that is when peace starts descending. Now, human beings suffer when their will does not correspond to God's will. What does this mean? It means when we see in our own lives that we are trying to do something a certain way, and we keep trying and keep trying and keep trying, but the result that we want does not happen. That creates suffering. What I think is my will, and then I want an outcome based on that will, and I do not get the desired outcome, that creates suffering. This is all part of the Leela. And then consciousness brings about an awakening, an inquiry, that all this strife and struggle and doership that I am trying so hard to perpetuate to deliver a desired outcome is not helping. And the human being now accepts that sometimes I do not get what I want. Sometimes I get what I want. So the sense of doership is brought into the forefront. It is the doership that creates the suffering. Let's make no mistake here that suffering will continue in a particular body-mind organism if it is destined to, and if awakening is destined to happen, consciousness will bring about the circumstances in a particular individual. In some cases, it will be an insight, a teaching, whatever it may be. When the human being sees that my precious free will, which I have been trying to impose in order to get the outcomes, does not give a 100% guaranteed result. So when the human being accepts that in life, I do what I think and feel I should do, knowing that it is not truly my will, knowing that the results are not really in my control, that suffering, which Rameshji is pointing to, ceases. And that ceasing of the suffering is also not the individual's doing. It is happening thanks to the grace of consciousness. Consciousness has created the circumstances, created the suffering, brought about the conditions for inquiry, for wondering what life is about. And then consciousness brings about the insights, the awakening, that while I live my life accepting that my will is truly God's will, I now live more relaxed, knowing that nobody truly does anything. We are all instruments of the divine, and no matter how hard I try, the results are not in my control. This is all brought about by consciousness. When the individual realizes this, the suffering which is based on doership, that ceases. There are millions upon millions of people who have tremendous psychological suffering. And then there are few chosen by God, as Rameshji would say, Allah ke pyare, who have the good fortune of looking at the suffering, wondering what it is about, while so many others continue suffering unconsciously, subconsciously, or consciously. In other words, for them, the journey within has still not begun. It will only begin when it is meant to begin. And for those few who through suffering and loss have realized that nothing in life gives me peace because it is so temporary, so transient, so fleeting. Nothing is reliable. Then the turning within starts. So the difference between the sage and the ordinary person is that the sense of doership and all the psychological suffering associated with it have completely dissolved. With the total acceptance of God's will, the sage has no wish to impose his will on anyone. The sage does not live in an imaginary future. In other words, what should be, according to what I feel how things should be. And the sage does not live in the dead past which is gone. What should have been, what could have been. There is no psychological suffering for the sage. When in your life, you notice that you are living less and less in the dead past or the imaginary future, then you know that the teaching is sinking deep. You go with the flow. Now, another question. I have taken this up because it is an honest current situation. Yesterday, I went to a park with a few friends, as we did not see each other for about 6 months due to the lockdown. During our conversation, my friend's husband asked, "Why is it that Trump never gets punished? He lies, steals, never shows his taxes, is rude to others, and is filthy rich. Why is it that some people are so bad, and in spite of that, they continue to live among us without any regret? Where is God in this?" Another friend's husband responded that people like Trump exist to show us that there is no God. I was listening to this conversation and knew the answer, that God created both healthy people and disabled people, and bad people and good people, because this world is a world of paradox. However, I did not open my mouth to respond. Now we are coming to the essence of this question, which really has not much to do with Trump. However, I did not open my mouth to respond. I left feeling little dejected, and at the same time knew deep inside that the people who are saying these words are also the same consciousness. My question to you is my not responding to these comments also God's will? Or is it the fear of my ego being bruised? Most beautiful question. This is why I love practical daily living questions. And that is why I emphasize it so much, because there is so much out there in terms of teachings which all talk about there is no person here, there is nobody this, nobody that. No, we are going to deal with this honesty. Is not the responding to these comments also God's will? Or is it the fear of my ego being bruised? I am having a hard time letting it go. Please shed some light on this. Now, this is quite important. What happens with the understanding? You are in a group. A group has opinions. Some members of the group are vociferous, some are timid. Some are louder than others. And therefore, they pronounce their opinion on matters. And perhaps, if a timid person by nature has a contrary opinion, they browbeat him, telling him how wrong he is and how right they are. This is everybody's experience. The stronger ones, so to speak, want to impose their opinion as being the right opinion. Now, what happens when someone is in this group, like this lady, who has come to a certain understanding? The question is, what does she do now? Now, one is, she does precisely what is in her nature to do. Two things could emerge. Either she expresses her opinion, or out of fear, as she says, of her ego being bruised, in case the group members say something against her, she keeps quiet. Now, this is crucial to understand. If one's nature is to express one's opinion, one expresses one's opinion. It's as simple as that, knowing that the results of expressing my opinion are not in my control. People may like what I say, they may not like what I say. If I have the fear of my ego being bruised, it means I am invested in my opinion. It means I want a certain outcome, and if I don't get that outcome, my ego will be bruised because I will be told I am wrong. The sage can have an opinion. The sage is not a zombie. The sage is not going to keep quiet. If he is asked his views, he may express them. But he knows deep down whether my views are accepted or rejected is not in my control. So the sage will not defend his point of view. The sage will not try to convince the others again and again and again. No, you are wrong. I am right. None of that need arises for the sage. He may engage in a discussion. He may elaborate on his point of view for clarity. But he has no investment in the outcome because he knows that God's will prevails. So there is no question of the ego of the sage being bruised. Now, to go one step further, one may find with this teaching that even the need to express the opinion stops arising. That can also happen because you feel there are already enough opinions floating around. Truly, my opinion on the subject may or may not matter. I don't know. So it could be that for someone with the understanding, he or she will express their opinion, perhaps only if they are asked. But if they find themselves sitting at a dinner table and one side is discussing Trump and another side is discussing Biden or whoever it may be, they may just be passive listeners. And if asked to share their opinion, they share their opinion. That compulsive need to jump into the ring, so to speak, drops for the sage. Because the sage knows that there's no end to opinions. The sage knows that no matter what opinions people have, the results are not in their control. So I am telling you all this because you could find a kind of disengagement and a disassociation from this compulsive need to foist your opinion on others. That starts happening. And more importantly, you accept, if there are two differing opinions on a subject, you accept that both are equally relevant to the concerned parties. That is your opinion. All right. That is your opinion based on your conditioning, your genetics. All right. That is why I don't tire of using my guru's phrase, you agree to disagree without being disagreeable. If you don't agree to an opinion, you agree to disagree without being disagreeable. Unfortunately, for the majority, it is the opposite. They want to enforce their viewpoint on others, and then they criticize and condemn all the people who share one particular point of view. So this is called living on the extreme polarities, which is duality, the extreme polarization, the extreme duality. Either this or this. There is no end to it. Because the minute you take up one polarity, you have created the other. And the dance of duality goes on till the day Kali comes in front of you, as they say, to chop off your head, which of course is referring to the ego symbolically, till it takes a big blow for one to come to one's senses. And as Ramana Maharshi says, sometimes it takes 4 or 5 blows from life to make one wake up. What is this? That is why it is said that the wise one, when they see Kali coming, they bow and offer their head to Kali, knowing that the Divine Mother, Consciousness, Shakti, Parashakti, coincidentally it's Navratri now, the start of Navratri, the 9 days of the Divine Goddess. So, to look at this last sentence again, is my not responding to these comments also God's will? Most certainly. Or is it the fear of my ego being bruised? It could be both. It is, of course, God's will that you didn't respond. But it could also be that the reason you didn't respond is the fear of your ego being bruised. Even that fear is God's will. But only you will know that maybe I didn't respond because I felt the futility of it. Or maybe I was itching to give my opinion, but I restrained myself knowing that I might be laughed at. That too is God's will, but only you will know which of the two it is. And this teaching does not mean that even if you feel like that, even if you feel deep inside, oh, I'm itching to give my opinion, but I fear my ego will be bruised. There is no right or wrong. It could be that. It could be the fear of the ego being bruised. But the point is, this fear of the ego being bruised can only happen when there is a sense of doership still present. Otherwise, what will happen? You will express your opinion. Let's say you are laughed at by the group. You feel bad. That is also God's will. But you do not carry a load. These people laughed at me. These people didn't agree with me. I hate them. These people made me feel small. How dare they? That dialogue is finished for the sage. Because even if the sage is laughed at by the group, the sage knows this too is God's will. This was meant to happen. The sage does not take it personally. They laughed at me. No, the sage, for the sage, I said something. People didn't agree with. They found it absurd. They laughed. God's will. So the sage is not carrying this whole baggage of feeling and fearing that the ego will be bruised. Because if the sense of doership is uprooted from the ego, where is the question of the fear of being bruised? If your ego is bruised, it is a fantastic opportunity to look at the real and the unreal. It has got nothing to do with the others bruising your ego. The bruise is yours. If you are honest with yourself, you will drop the dialogue of being bruised by others. Now, if we keep this aside and go one step further, and basically what the Indian scriptures say, supposing you enter a hall of mirrors, hundreds of mirrors all around you, and you are in the middle, mirrors above, mirrors below, mirrors to the left, mirrors to the right. Now you enter this hall, let's say, angry, and you have a scowl on your face. What is it that you see? You see yourself in all the mirrors reflected, angry. Now, supposing you enter the hall of mirrors, calm, equanimous, and at peace, what do you see? You see hundreds of yourself, calm, equanimous, and at peace. That is why it is said that the manifestation is an appearance of consciousness within consciousness, not outside of consciousness. If all there is consciousness, everything is an appearance within that consciousness, of course, right? It cannot be outside consciousness. So if consciousness enters the hall of mirrors, everything that appears is an appearance within consciousness. Supposing one enters the house of mirrors without the body. If you enter this house of mirrors, let's say, even if you find this abstract, that the body is removed and you enter as pure awareness, what you will see is the absence of the bodies in the hundreds of mirrors. Actually, the seeing goes because the eyes of duality are not there. But let's just stay with this example. If consciousness just enters the house of mirrors without the body, there is no reflection of bodies within consciousness. There is no projection. You see how absurd this situation is, how absurd the Maya is. We've entered the house of mirrors as an individual, but in the reflection, we see bodies of others, and on those bodies and on the foreheads of those others, we have stuck labels of judgments. He is a kind person, he is a miser, I hate him, I love her, she does not respond to me well, so on and so forth and so forth. This is what has happened. Through this maya of separation, thinking others as separate from myself, with separate bodies, with separate attributes. And so, this projection onto others of one's own issues, that starts happening. And then, this sense of separation creates suffering. And then the suffering brings about the inquiry, what is going on? Why do I have so many problems in my relationships? Why do I suffer so much in life situations? And then, perhaps, something comes along and the Maya starts getting exposed for what it is. I start seeing things differently. I start seeing people differently. My seeing becomes clearer and clearer and clearer. I see the one source, the one consciousness at play in life. And so I find that my judgments, not only about people, but about situations, my judgments lose their meaning. I see everything as an expression of the one divine consciousness. And with that, when this compulsive thinking mind of the ego starts getting disengaged in life, I enter as the light of presence in the hall of mirrors. Therefore, what you see is not outside you, it is within you. The saying, what you see is what you get. No. What you see is what you are. Okay. If anyone would like to share anything or has any questions, we can take them now. Yes, Holger.
In a way, I don't want to say anything, but it's so amazing to listen to you. And when I look at you and hear you, and I just see, like you said, it's really the source at play. And it's just beauty and intelligence. And just want to thank you for this. It's amazing. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Yes, Kumar.
Namaste, Gautam, sir. I had a doubt.
You can drop the Mr. and you can drop the sir, but if you are comfortable with it, you can keep it.
So, I had a question about, you say we have to drop the personal doership, and then there is a thing like you do what you think you feel you should do. So, earlier this used to confuse me, but then I rapidly realized with my observation that no matter what we think, actions just happen, like even in the example you gave. So whether that woman should speak or not, she would just act according to her conditioning. So it's just a subtle nuance of words. Anyways, what we think, whether we are confused, actions will happen irrespective.
Yes, that is very true. But one final point is that you cannot drop the personal doership. It is, you are the personal doership. You see, the ego with its sense of doership is so intertwined. What happens is the teaching comes up. When you accept nobody truly does anything, the sense of doership drops by itself. You see? So, of course, it is the nature of someone timid, as we talked about this example, that maybe she feels intimidated to share her point of view because there's fear of the ego being bruised. That, of course, is meant to happen. It is meant to happen. But the difference is that when there is no sense of doership, you will not feel guilty that, oh, I could not express my opinion. Because a lot of us do that, you know, we're very hard on ourselves. And the fear of being rejected by others, which is also God's will, it may not go away. The fear may be there. But that fear will be seen in a different light. That even this fear is meant to happen. So you see, the beauty of this teaching is there's nothing which is rejected at all. But the nuance, as you said, changes. Because maybe I find another situation, me as the same person, as the same girl, finds another situation where I express the opinion. The circumstances are such that it came out. Like you said so rightly, not in one's control. The actions are not in one's control, you see. And thereafter, what happens is not in one's control. So it could vary situation to situation also. The same person in one situation may feel that my ego could be bruised, and in another situation, somehow the strength comes to express the opinion. But thereafter, the knowing is there totally, that the expressing of the opinion was not my doing. In this situation, it happened, and how it will be received is not my doing, nor the others doing either. And a deep, deep peace, which is nothing but the thinking mind stopping, not going in all these different directions on the basis of how people react to me, what I said, all that goes. So one is abiding in peace. That is the beauty of it. Okay?
And what you say about this profound, that it is to be. So I was contemplating on this. So in a way, all the subtle mystical spiritual experiences, aren't they kind of a disturbance which takes one more away from the reality and daily living, and rather develops an ego of those experiences? And they can be just unnecessary, or they might have some role.
You see, this is a most commonly asked question, and you're quite right. It is not necessary to have spiritual experiences. In fact, my teacher would say that they prove to be a hindrance, because having an experience means the experiencer has to be there for the experience to happen. You see, So the whole point is, spiritual experiences, when they happen, I look at them as signposts and nothing more. If there is a sense of self derived from the spiritual experience, it can be most dangerous. And I have seen this many times, that people who have spiritual experiences consider themselves a bit more special. I have seen it. I have had this experience, you see. And then, rightly so, this starts becoming the stumbling block. Why? Because now, this experience one seeks again and again. What will be my next experience? I had this experience. That is how the ego operates. It thrives on experiences. Why? Because experiences make the ego feel special. But the wise one may have an experience, may not. In fact, Maharaj said, better not to have any experiences. You see? He said, the realized ones don't even know that realization has happened. Those are the truly realized ones. I have read it in I Am That. But the point is, experiences are signposts meant to be seen that way. But because the ego is such a mischievous piece of work, it latches on to the experience and then creates trouble for itself. That is what tends to happen. Okay?
Thank you,
sir. Yes, Sutara.
Namaste, Gautamji, Uttraya. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Gautamji, I want to share an experience, and I also actually have a dilemma. I'll share the dilemma first. I'm in the profession of a banking. I'm a business banker by profession. So this is just a bit of background. So I carry in my profession, it is my daily duty to, when a situation arises, to actually judge whether this person is speaking the truth or not, and look at the documents presented in front of me to see the validity of the documents and make a judgment. So that's my working mind. Now, somehow that mind overlaps with my thinking mind when I'm not actually working. So kind of that, I carry that with me home, and somehow I don't know how to differentiate whether what I'm thinking in my daily living, in my normal course of living, I somehow seem to be judging people and kind of thinking whether they're saying the truth or not, which is part of my working brain into my daily living as well. I find it extremely hard not to do that in my normal course, because I do that like 8 to 10 hours a day. And then it's like a 100-meter dash. I'm running so fast that when I need to stop, I'm still running to stop, if you know what I mean. That's my one dilemma. And an experience that was a surprise test after the last satsang was when we were at satsang last week. Towards the end of the satsang, I had a knock on my door. So I had to stop my video and I had to attend the door. And there was this lady. I live overseas, so it's very unusual for someone to come and knock on the door without making appointments. I live alone, so with my daughter. So it was a bit surprising that someone would knock on the door unannounced. She was a stranger, unknown to me. And she used the word that I have been watching you for a while, and that I came to find a job. And I've been watching you for a while, that word, it kind of raised antennas that it shouldn't. And again, my working mind or my thinking mind, or whichever mind, I don't know, it came into action and I said, well, that's not good. Someone has been watching me for a while. And so I thought, that's not nice. However, because I was in between the satsang, I gave her the time. I came out and I said to her, look, give me your CV. Have you got your visas? Like, I gave her the time. 6 months ago, before Advaita, I wouldn't have given her the time. I would have said, I'm sorry, I don't know you, you're a stranger, and you're creeping me out, bye. But this time I had to actually give her the time. I gave her the time unknowingly because I was in the midst of satsang and I took time out to go out and have a conversation with her and say, give me your passports, give me your CV, let me check your validity of stuff. And then I'll see what I can do for you. Bring it to me tomorrow at 6 o'clock. She never came back, but it kind of, two things, it like creeped me out. At the same time, life threw a surprise test at me and I was very unsettled after it. So just wanted to share that experience. But yeah, the dilemma is still there.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing this, really. See, Uttara, you must understand that the working mind and thinking mind are concepts. Just to clarify and throw light on the functioning of the mind. Now, supposing your mind is tuned a certain way, okay? Like you said, at work, it works brilliantly. In your work related to banking or whatever it is, it's, you have to judge what is a good application, what is not, who's being truthful, who is not. That is the beauty of the working mind in operation. Now, similarly, we all look at people in our lives in the same way. We always want to see who's really transparent, open, who's not. So this is a quality of the mind. You see, the difference is that the thinking mind is the mischief maker. What the thinking mind does is beyond getting an insight into a person, it blames the person. You see, the working mind may say that let's say I've made a new friend, okay? Someone I've met a couple of times and it seems we get along, you know? That's the mind in operation because you're a certain age, you may not be keen on too many friends, you're busy. So the mind is doing its job, which is the nature of the mind, okay? What happens is, when will you know that it is the thinking mind and not the working mind? When judgments creep in and then preferences build up based on doership. Oh, I don't like this person because she or he said this. That is when the thinking mind starts. But if one's mind is that whoever I come across, my nature is to understand them first and see where they are coming from. There's nothing wrong in that. Some people are built that way. Some people are very open and trusting. Some people are built the opposite. But there's nothing wrong in a mind which is trying to make sense of a person, a family member, a stranger. That is still the working mind in operation. For example, the common example as I've used is about the surgeon conducting the operation. Now, let's say the surgeon goes home, is having his cup of tea. It could happen that the thought comes up that, oh, this surgery is scheduled for tomorrow. And this is, oh, I remember this document, this case study, something I had read. That is all the working mind in operation. Okay. But now, suddenly, if the surgeon, while having his cup of tea, starts feeling fear, and my God, now I'm really nervous about this surgery, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Then you know the thinking mind has kicked in because it has gone into an imaginary future. So this is important for you to look at because you have understood the working mind and the thinking mind. It could very well be that beyond your working hours or your relationships, you're still operating with the working mind and there is no problem in that. The problem is there suffering being created for you by the working of that mind? That is what is to be looked at. Am I obsessing about people being the way I think they should be or what they should be saying? Or is my mind functioning impartially and given its nature, just objectively looking at people, analyzing how they are, and that's fine. Or am I getting sleepless nights because my mind is creating stories upon stories upon stories about people? That is the thinking mind. Am I sleeping well? Working mind was in operation. You see how it is?
Yeah, true.
So we have just kind of compartmentalized it for an ease of understanding. The mind is the mind. You see, when there's a sense of doership and separation, the thinking mind is kicking in. When that sense of doership is not there, the working mind is in operation. It's as simple as that. Has that answered your question?
Yes. Yes, definitely, Gautam.
Now coming to this person who rang your doorbell, the surprise test, as you so rightly said. You see, none of the circumstances were in your control. Even the fact that while the satsang was going on, your doorbell rang was not in your control. Right? So, whatever was your reaction at this point, and as you said earlier, it would have freaked you out completely. But at this point, you found yourself asking for the documents and taking them. It was just circumstantial, you see. The most important point is being creeped out is so natural because the doorbell rings when it's not supposed to. In your case, you are with your daughter. So the being creeped out can also arise even with the understanding. Isn't it natural? It's natural.
Yes.
Okay. But the difference is, it's a very subtle difference with this teaching. There is a sense of acceptance. So what you realize is, with time perhaps, I accept life is full of surprises. I accept. This is not a verbal acceptance. I'm just using words to give a feeling of what happens. That the doorbell can ring. I accept that I could be creeped out. But despite all this, with the teaching, with the understanding provided by the teaching, there is an underlying sense of knowing that whatever happens is God's will. So the door is open, the person says something, I still feel creeped out. I may even tell the person that, hey, you know, you creeped me out by ringing the doorbell. Anything can happen. But because one is now accepting life so much more and more and more, accepting what the next moment brings, accepting my reaction to the next moment, this gives what Rameshji would call, and this he used this phrase in his early years, not even when I was there, living the life courageous. Living the life courageous. This is what starts happening, not as a doing, not as an intellectual doing, as a feeling of being more open to what the next moment may bring. You see, this does not mean that you will be okay with the doorbell ringing. This teaching does not say that. That would be absurd. Because a biological reaction, a natural biological reaction for survival, let's say, will kick in. Obviously, it's the same reaction which makes you, before crossing the road, look left or right. But you accept that while I may look left and right before crossing the road, whether or not I reach the other side is not in my control. That is what starts happening with this understanding, you see. It reminds me of the most unfortunate incident I had heard of. You know, we stay in South Bombay and there's a strip called Marine Drive. It's a long C-shaped strip by the sea. And maybe 20 or 30 buildings away, years ago, I heard about this most unfortunate story of someone's daughter who was quite what should I say, a rebel, you know. And the mother used to keep telling her not to cross the road at random. She would just run across. She wouldn't care. It was, you know, you go, the joggers go and the walkers go early morning for the walks. So not adhering to the zebra crossing because there are not enough cars in the morning. And the mother would keep cautioning her. And apparently, it seems that she was hit by a car when she was on the zebra crossing. Now look at that destiny.
Mm.
Isn't it crazy?
Yes.
Doesn't make sense. There are no guarantees in life.
True.
There are no guarantees in life. And what so many of us do, the boat of life is going from birth to death, from one bank to the other. And what we try to do is we have this huge heavy anchor which we are trying to drop down onto the bed of the river. And what happens? We only suffer. We get stuck. We are completely stuck with this false sense of security we are trying to create. This should not happen to me. I can control it. With the teaching, one finds, one is going with the flow of life, knowing that the boat is going to reach the other shore at some point or another. So why struggle against the current? Why create unnecessary suffering? That is what starts happening. Okay?
Thank you, Gautamji. Thank you so much.
Yes, Priyam.
Good morning, sir. I don't have a question. You can hear me, right?
I can hear you, but I can't see you. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here and my video is on.
One sec. Can somebody help us see Priyam? It's quite possible that I pressed the wrong button. So there you are. Welcome back.
Thank you, sir. I didn't go anywhere. I was like watching on YouTube. I was just not joining on Zoom. I just want to share my experiences the last few weeks. So sometimes when I'm like contemplating about this, then I find it all really funny.
You find it funny? Yeah, even I find it funny. I can't hear you now, Priyam. I don't know why. Can you?
Hello? Hello?
After funny,
can you hear me, sir?
Repeat yourself after the word funny.
Yeah, I find it funny because I think that we are all going through the experience of life and expecting so much out of each other. And I found it funny that we are all stuck in our own psychological prison. So there was this humorous compassion for everyone and for myself included, that we expect other people to change and to go according to us. And then I realized that sometimes it's so hard to even change ourselves. Like I've been trying to get up at 4 a.m. and then I realized it's so difficult. Then I realized it's so difficult to change my own tendencies. So I kind of found it funny that we are all going through the experience of life and the collective daily suffering and so many pains and stuff like that. And then also expecting other people to go according to our wishes. So sometimes I really laugh about this. It feels like a big cosmic joke to me. And then there are times when I feel so frustrated. I feel like, why did the source energy have to get bored and then create these individual body, mind, organisms to experience itself? And then to make the game of hide and seek so hard, like to keep it in a world which is full of apparent pleasures and empty happiness, and then keep it right inside each of us where we wouldn't even think of looking. And so yeah, sometimes it creates frustration, like why was consciousness even ripped out of that void and placed as individuals to suffer? So there is this play of sometimes finding it like a big cosmic play and laughing, and sometimes being really angry And what has changed is that there is this deep layer of understanding that both the sense of humor and the sense of frustration, I'm just becoming aware of that. So both of them are just arising in my consciousness. I'm just becoming aware of that. So that is when I kind of have this gentle smile instead of the humor or frustration. So that is what has changed. Like this has started to come in that whatever is arising, whether it be laughter, looking at this divine joke, or anger, it's still just me becoming aware of both of these arising. So yeah, that has been my experience of late. I just wanted to share.
That's fantastic. I loved what you said. It actually sums everything up. It's so beautiful. You know, there are two perspectives here. One is, you see the helplessness of the situation. It's so fantastic when one sees that people can't help being who they are.
Yeah.
And there are two subtle aspects here also. One is, as you so rightly said, it becomes such a cosmic joke. You know, it's like Shiva is laughing all the time. That's what your experience is now of life, of people. It's just fantastic because it is the theater of the absurd, as we could say. It just doesn't make sense. And it's so beautiful in that. The truths. Reality reveals itself in that. You see, as Maharaj would say, for example, he would say, what is all this fuss about? Firstly, he would tell anyone that if you are invested in the sense of doership, even your own birth was not your doing. You see. And he very clearly said, and I don't mince words. He clearly said, look at this life. Then this is when he was 82. He said, two people enjoyed for a brief moment and I had to suffer the consequences for 82 years. You see? Now, that has been expressed by many Advaitins, so to speak. And people don't like it because some people believe that life, you know, is joy and bliss and all, which it is. You see, you have to understand this, that the human birth is a gift in the sense that it is the only consciousness on the planet that is gifted this ability to introspect, go within and be aware. The other species function on instinct. It is not that the human being is superior to the animal, but this being aware principle, I am, is a gift. And so, to know that this is the living dream of life, and all the highs, all the lows, all the sorrow, all the happiness, all the play of duality. And this knowing makes it look really so funny. Why? Because at one sense you feel it is so unreal and yet it moves me so much. So this question of why, which is only placed there by the thinking mind, wanting to make sense of it, that gets cut off. For the sage, that why question is finished because he knows, and you have so beautifully expressed it, that this is life. This is what it is about. This is how it is, whether I like it or I don't like it. That's beautiful. It is really funny. It reminds me when Eckhart had said once, you know, that sometimes when people ask questions, he feels like laughing, not in ridicule, because the funniness of life is seen you know, that what the ego holds so precious and so dear and so much, the absurdity of that is seen, and then therefore you feel like you really start laughing sometimes. You will find that in the most absurd of situations or strenuous of situations, a laughter might come because it is seen through. It is seen through. That is what happens. Everything is seen through. And seen through what? Seen through the eye of singularity, which is the witness. The dance of duality is seen through the eye of singularity. That is what makes a person find all this funny. That is why Maharaj said, I was born crying and I will die laughing. Anything else you'd like to share, Priyam?
No, so thank you so much. I've been reading your book, Explosion of Love, and yesterday the whole passage you wrote about Joan of Arc, that really inspired me, because the way she was, her entire story, and how she was so much in acceptance, that was really beautiful and very, very inspiring. So thank you for writing that book. I'm really enjoying the little essays.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care. I hope your painting is going well.
I recently made a move, a very big move from Southern India to Northern India, which was very stressful kind of during the pandemic, traveling and packing all my paintings by myself. So yeah, but it is, I'm so grateful that it happened finally. So yeah, painting and everything is going well.
Good, good. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Yes, Sunita.
Namaste, Gautam ji. Can you hear me?
You are very faint. I'm sorry. Can you speak louder or maybe hold the mic closer to yourself?
Yeah, one second. Can you hear me now? No?
Very faintly, unless...
Oh, okay.
I think I'm on now. Nice.
That's good.
Hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. First of all, thank you very much. Once again, I'm here today to thank you. And also, I have a question, a few questions and few experiences. So let me put my question first. So my question is that we, according to the teaching, earlier I used to be very judgmental about people. The moment I see people, the moment I see things, this person, and as the teaching rightly said, we used to label people, she's bad, she's kind, she's doing this or he's doing this and that. But later on, as I've been along the journey with you all through the satsangs, learned that it's a part of me that I see in them creates that thing that, this is wrong or right. So how do I correct myself? So it is something in me that I lack, that I see in them as a negative thing, right? So how do I correct myself, or will it consciousness correct itself? How does this work?
There is no question of correcting something. Knowing and seeing it, that itself is the correction. The sheer fact that you now know and you see it as an aspect of yourself, that is all the correction that is needed. And that is what will lead to a different way of seeing. So you see, it is not really about a lack, because we all have these attributes, jealousy, envy. How do we know them? We have experienced them at some point in our lives. So we know if we call someone else a jealous person, we know what jealousy is. It's human nature. These are all attributes of human nature. What happens? For some people, it's just slapped on to others and they think that they are the paragons of virtue. But with the understanding, the sage knows that everyone is made by the same source. And everyone has pluses and minuses, flaws and whatever you call it, that's irrelevant, just like I have. So what happens is that compulsive need to label someone as against myself who is not like that, that in any case has dropped for you, because you have said that you realize it's your own projection and it's a part of you in that sense. So there's nothing here which is lacking. What happens is the understanding transforms the relationship. Wouldn't you say that the relationship is transformed or healed at some level? Or you would say that's not happening?
What is happening is related to your the first question, the second question the lady had asked about the Trump person. You know, she has something she wants to express, but you know, she's doubtful whether it's her ego that's afraid that it will get hurt or whether it's God's will that it's accepting. So for me, it's like this, that am I really accepting the person? Because I see that, you know, what is I'm seeing, for example, a person is behaving this way, and you know, I'm feeling that it's not correct or what it's something like that. So if I feel that, is it my understanding? Who am I to judge whether she's correct or not? It is her or hence, you know, as you say, they're, you know, raising the way they have been taught to, or they've been, it's the way it's they are designed to be. So, you know, who am I to judge? But certain times I have a question. So, for example, if you are in a group and I really want to, tell some opinion, then I sometimes say, is it really worth it giving my opinion? Will it change anything? What is going to be the outcome? Will it disturb my mind? This is one part. Second part says within me, hey, is it my ego is afraid that, you know, it's the same exact question that lady had, that is it my ego that's it'll feel bad that if I, you know, people might think she doesn't have enough information or she has a different opinion or something like that. So I just keep quiet nowadays. So I don't know whether it's right or wrong, which is so unlikely of me, you know.
Isn't that beautiful?
It is. I feel happy. And I also wanted to share with you, since I've come back to Luxembourg, I feel really at peace with myself. And, you know, earlier I used to have so many unaccepting things that, because, you know, I have shared with you earlier too that I used to be a very planned kind of a personality. So like, but now I say, to Baba that, yes, I'm keeping these desires at your feet. Whether it happens or not, you know what is the best. As you say, you know, a girl and a boy get together. Maybe in the long run, it's not good for them to be together. You know, it was not what they were meant for. You ask and God gives you. So I tell you, you know what is best, because we don't understand in your, exactly, according to your meditation.
Exactly.
Complexities of life. So whatever is the best you give. Desire, being desireful is, I think, a human's nature. So I'm keeping this in front of you. And I carry on with my work. I think that is what the teaching has done to me, yes, in the 6 months. So grateful to you.
Yes, and you have answered most of your questions. So maybe when you see the recording, you will get the answers and can even take this further the next time we meet here. So because now time is up.
Sure. Thank you.
Beautiful, because I'm so happy to see in all these cases, you know, that obviously the teaching been absorbed at some level, otherwise these kind of questions would not have arisen. So it's really beautiful to see across all of you that there's change, and change in perspective to one of harmony. That is why Rameshji would say harmony in relationships. That is what one finds happening at any level, even if it's not outwardly for some time. Inwardly, there's a change because you accept the person who they are. Because after all, we are operating on methods of old conditioning also. So that also has to be factored in, you see. But harmonious thoughts about others start happening. So we may not approve of something, as you say, but there's a shift because now the knowing is there. So that shift in understanding has taken place. Like you said, maybe this need to express the opinion also has dropped. And earlier, so many of us are hardwired to, you know, pounce. And if someone says something we don't like, we get at them, for example. That also used to happen, could happen. But the intensity and the involvement in all this is reduced. That is what starts happening. That is the gift of the teaching. Okay. So we'll end this for today on some minutes of silence.